Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books and Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Richard G. Marks, who is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Religion at Washington and Lee University. We'll be talking about a fascinating new book called Jewish Approaches to Hinduism, A History of Ideas from Judah Halevi to Jacob Sapir. And we'll learn more about those figures as we continue the podcast. And this podcast will certainly be cross-posted to new books in Jewish studies as well. So Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here with you.
So you have what strikes me as a fascinating niche and interest in study in that. If I'm not mistaken, one of the things you study is the way in which Hinduism has been received by various Jewish thinkers. Would that be an accurate characterization of your research interest?
Yeah, in a sense, it is a reception history. Especially a history of marred, spoiled reception of misunderstandings. But it is, how it Hinduism was received. And even the word Hinduism means something different for each of the authors that I studied. But it is that, yes.
I find it quite fascinating. Could you say a little bit, if you don't mind, about what drew you to this niche?
I spent about 5 or 6 years in Thailand teaching and became interested in Theravada Buddhism and learned about it. And that's what I know better than Hinduism. But I started asking myself as a Jewish scholar and as a Jew, what was the relationship between Judaism and Buddhism. And I came up with a few answers and mostly not, mostly questions, unanswered questions about Buddhism. Then as a Jewish scholar, I was trained at UCLA in the history of ideas, the history of Jewish ideas, I guess. And I realized that Jews encountered Southern Asia not through Buddhism until very recently, but through Hinduism. And that drew me to the subject of what they thought, what happened in their minds when they learned what they learned about the religion and practices, the beliefs and practices of South India.
I honestly find that quite rich for a number of reasons. Firstly, historically, but secondly, with respect to what we might learn in terms of interfaith discourse or reception of religion in modern times. So I feel that examining these views and these reception histories can be instructive for, you know, our present world. Would you agree with that? Or would you say it's too far removed?
Oh, well, I hope that my book will be instructive, illuminating, and will provide perspective for, I guess it's more Jews. Well, it could be both Jews and Hindus who are thinking about the other person's religion. For Jews, the perspective is just to see how Jews of the past who were immersed in their specific historical settings and had their own ideas and their own arguments and intellectual conflicts to face, how they, out of that historical particularity, how they engaged in the in thinking about Hinduism. And if a Jew today wants to develop a theology, a Jewish theology of Hinduism, it would be good to learn what religious Jews of the past have already done. And I think for Hindus, it would it's probably interesting to find out all the problems that another culture had in trying to understand their own religion.
Now, would you say the audience for this book is primarily, as you just characterize, as Jews or Hindus, or would you say that perhaps it's broader for those who may not be affiliated particularly with the religion, who just want to understand these dynamics?
Yes. I hope that people will be interested in finding out in learning about the problems and challenges of intercultural understanding and a whole history, a variety of mistakes that have been made in the past. But it's a very complicated enterprise to try to study people, to learn about people and speak honestly about them, people who live far away and usually in the case of the authors I studied, their information was secondhand or thirdhand, and they probably weren't aware of how faulty their information was. But anyway, there's just all sorts of problems involved in trying to understand a foreign people with a very complex and sophisticated way of life.
Now, I realize there's tons of data in the book. You look at 9 case studies, 9 situations. But with respect to what you're calling problems, the problems with this sort of encounter, do you want to highlight a couple and share what some of that, share in your view what has been problematic, or share a couple of the prime examples with us?
A good idea. But well, I'll start with the first one. Judah Halevi lived in 12th century Spain. He had an education in both traditional rabbinic texts, traditional Jewish texts, as well as a secular education in poetry and science and philosophy of the times. Arabic language philosophy. So he knew Arabic and he knew Hebrew. And he more or less assumed when he started talking about what the people were, well, when he started talking about Indian beliefs, he more or less assumed that he understood completely what they thought. They served a purpose in his book. This book was called The Khuzari, which was to defend traditional Judaism, especially against Aristotelian philosophy. The Indians served a particular purpose, a polemical purpose, which was much more important to him than trying to find out what they really thought. His image of them was composed of what was circulating in the Muslim world at that time. So almost all Spanish Jews of that period knew about India. They learned about India from Arabic travel reports, from Muslim geographies, from Muslim, heresiographies, that is, studies of other religions, also from Islamic science, which spoke a lot about Indian theories of mathematics, astrology, and astronomy. So the educated Jews of Spain thought they knew and had information, had at least data, about Indians. So all of this came together for Judah Halevi when he learned from this information that Indians claim to have very ancient buildings, older than the date of the Bible, and that they read a book called, that he knew as the Book of Nabataean Agriculture. And that book was, we know a lot about that book now, but it was a book of astrology and theurgy and agriculture, agricultural techniques. And it was based on the idea that the earth was eternal, that human civilization was very, very ancient, 10,000 and thousands of years old. The biblical date at his time was, I think, around 4,500 years old. So it was much older. So he inaccurately associated this book, which really came from the Middle East somewhere. He associated this book with Indians, especially because of astrology, and assumed that that's what they believed. So you have all the, together with all that, he took in what Muslims were saying about non-monotheistic religions. And they saw non-monotheistic religions as a combination of what they called Barahima and Sabaeans. The Barahima were ideological groups who rejected prophecy and later became associated with Brahmins. And the Sabaeans, who appear in the Quran three times, came to be understood, pictured by medieval Muslims as people who venerated the stars and planets in order to gain astrological power from them. And those two images came together in Halevi's view of Indians and built what he thought about them, built his image. So it was very complicated about what he actually knew about Indians. There were many influences on his thinking that he just assumed to be true. And there was this incomplete information that came from travel reports of Arab travelers who were not very sophisticated in talking about religion, and mainly talked about exotic, exciting things that they noticed, and didn't really talk to Indians in any depth. So this was a problem. Did I forgot what your question was.
Oh, the questions are always meant to be generative. It's probably best that you forgot how we began. So a figure such as the one that you're mentioning, what would you say the primary, if there is one, was there a primary bent, bias, polemic agenda? What do you think was sort of warping this view? Was it just simple, innocent, ignorance in the sense of the absence of proper knowledge? Or was there a particular agenda at play in this characterization of the Indian world?
I think you're right about both. I mean, some of it was innocent. He just accepted what everybody else was saying. It was information that was circulating in his environment. But there was an agenda also because, as I said, the Indian claimed to have ancient ruins and talking about a much older history of human beings, of human life. This threatened to undermine, to actually destroy his main claims about Jewish tradition. He claimed that we know the truth of Judaism because we have an accurate transmission of reports that that go all the way back to creation or ideas about creation. And this couldn't be true if you were to accept what Indians were saying. So he had to attack them, and he attacked them ferociously. It was the harshest attack on Indian thought that appears in the Middle Ages, or maybe the whole history of Jewish writings about Hinduism.
Would you say that it was harshest because it was earliest of the ones that you study? Otherwise put, is there a trajectory among the thinkers you look at between the 12th and 19th century of greater clarity, understanding, or does it ebb and flow?
That's a good question. I wish I had thought of that myself.
No, there is none. Questions, however naive sounding. No kidding.
I wrote another book called The Image of Bar Kokhba in Jewish Traditional Literature. And that that theme did develop historically. It came out of the Talmud. Oh, I should talk about who that is. Bar Kokhba was a Jewish rebel in Roman times, but he was also acclaimed the Messiah, so he had a very important theological association and sort of an important problem about being called the Messiah and then disappointing everybody who believed in him. So he was rather an important figure, and Jews kept returning to his story because it was in the Talmud. And I trace this tradition of storytelling and interpretation up until the 17th century. In the case of India, what I discovered is, first of all, there you can construct a history of Jewish views of India and Hinduism, because one might think that Jews never said anything about India and Hinduism, but they did. I discovered that they did, and it was rather interesting and complex what they said. But also, that in the case of Hinduism, the impetus for talking about Hinduism came from outside information. It didn't come from the Bible. It didn't come from rabbinic writings like the Talmud. But it was circulating in the world that these Jews lived in. And it was different information at different times. So, in addition, usually these Jewish authors didn't know about or didn't read what earlier Jewish authors had said. So it would be hard to have a progress. And in fact, two of the 19th century authors, the two travelers who visited India and observed Hindu religious life in person. They were probably the most prejudicial and disapproving of all the authors. And it didn't do any good for them to actually go to India because they didn't talk to Indians. They didn't, or when they did talk to Indians, excuse me, they imposed their own ideas. They didn't listen. They had no sense of Indian feelings about their religious practices. So it was almost, it surprised me to learn that there were,
take your time.
So it surprised me to learn that Jewish thinkers of the past could be much more open-minded about Hindu beliefs and practices than these 19th century travelers.
That's really fascinating, actually. So was there anything else that surprised you? What stood out to you about these approaches that you study?
Yes, what interested me the most and really kind of excited me, and it was the biggest challenge, was to understand that each of these authors had very different views from the others. And each of the authors' approaches to the Hinduism that they imagined, each of their approaches was different. It had to do with each author's own ideas and intellectual challenges, the intellectual setting that they lived in, and especially the information. The information kept changing over time, what they were learning about Hinduism. All of this came together. It was just very complex, but it was also sort of fun to pull out these threads and see how it all came together with each of these authors. But another answer to that question is I was surprised that the 19th century travelers were among the most disparaging of the authors that I studied. The travelers, that was surprising. Just as disparaging as Judah Halevi in the 12th century. But there were also very open-minded, very even admiring authors. The most admiring author was Jacob ben Eleazar in 13th century Toledo in Spain. And he studied, he translated a book that came from India, the Panchatantra, that had been translated into Persian and then translated into Arabic. And he translated the Arabic version of it, which was quite distant by then from the original Sanskrit version. He translated that into Hebrew. And he imagined this book as the Torah, the guidance that Indian philosophers, Indian leaders discovered for themselves through their own reasoning, because they lacked revelation. In his mind, they could tell that there was a God and a good God in the universe. And this God had a moral law that people had to follow, but they wanted to learn more. And they hoped for a prophet to come to them, but a prophet never did. So they decided they had to write down what they could work out through their own mental abilities. And they worked this out, and they told these lessons, these moral lessons, through animal stories. Which was the Panchatantra. The original Panchatantra was about political advice, and it was rather Machiavellian. But by the time it became the Arabic version, it was more moralistic. And then Jacob ben Eleazar made it even more moralistic and theological, so that God, that morality was based on following the laws of God. Anyway, he was very admiring. And then another admiring author was Samson Bloch in the 19th century, who lived in Eastern Europe. And he was part of the Jewish Enlightenment movement called Haskalah. And for him, learning about foreign nations was about escaping the stultifying rabbinic education that he had grown up in. It was about going out into the world. And in fact, he called his book Pathways of the World, Shevi'i Olam. And India was the almost the first chapter of that. And what he wanted his readers to learn from what he said about India, which was both about its vegetation and its culture, what he wanted them to learn was that there are a lot, well, first of all, that nature everywhere is the same and it always shows the glories of God. So there was a theological aspect to it. But about culture, which is, you would wonder, what are Jews supposed to learn from a foreign culture? He thought that they could learn about the commonalities among human beings. He believed that there were many common features. And he identified common beliefs and practices between Hindus and Jews. And this was very open-minded in this group of Jewish authors that I studied. So, for example, he said, Hindu, he didn't call them Hindus, he called them Indians, started off with a monotheistic belief in God and a transcendent God and a God who could not be worshipped in temples. And he compared that with Solomon's prayer about God. After Solomon instructed the temple in Jerusalem that really God could not be contained in this temple. So he quotes the Bible a lot. For the talking about the Brahmins, he uses biblical language that the Bible uses for the Kohanim, the priests in the Bible, that they were a kingdom of priests and a holy people. So he says that's very similar between Hindus and Jews. And the ethics, he said, was the same. It was the same golden rule as the Torah and the Vedas, he said. The Torah, the Vedas, and Confucius. So that was very open-minded too.
Yeah, this is all quite fascinating. One of the questions that I had in the back of my mind was, you know, Hinduism is the word that we have. It's sort of the label we have. We use it in world religion textbooks. We use it. This podcast used to be called New Books in Hinduism, Hindu Studies. And yet Hinduism is sort of this umbrella term for a plethora of practices and beliefs. And so one wonders, perhaps these Jewish thinkers and theologians, what varieties of Hinduism were they encountering? Were they encountering Vedic, Vedic recitation, Vedantic philosophy, or was it more sectarian practice or temple worship? Or, you know, what was their exposure to quote unquote Hinduism?
It was temple worship. It was devotional temple worship, the popular one that travelers could observe from the outside with their own eyes and then report about this. So that's what came from in the Middle Ages. That's what came from travelers' reports. Abraham Ibn Ezra, who lived also in medieval Spain, more or less ignored that aspect of Hinduism. And he was an astronomer and an astrologer. And he had been studying Arabic books about Indian mathematics and science. And so for him, what Hinduism was, if you can call it that, but let me call it Indian thought. What Indian thought was for him was science. And to him, it looked like Aristotelian thinking, because they as astrologers and, well, as astronomers, they saw the movement of the sun and moon, planets and stars, and had important theories about all of that, made their way westward into Spain. So that was his part of his image. The other part, very interesting to me, seems to me, is that Arab travelers were reporting that Indians were very moral people. They they behaved with innate justice. And if you were a merchant and you came to an Indian kingdom, then the king would guarantee the safety of your merchandise and the safety of your person. And Ibn Ezra even said that the Indians did not need most of the Ten Commandments, which were the ones that were ethical prohibitions, because they were already ethical people. They didn't need all of the Ten Commandments. So he had that image of them also.
I find that utterly fascinating. That he would make that observation, and secondly, that he would so blasphemously characterize that observation as these people not needing the Ten Commandments.
Yes. Yeah. He was a relativist about the Ten Commandments. There were certain commandments that various groups of people, not just the Indians in the world, did not need.
You know, I have to ask you about the usage of a certain verse in the Torah, Genesis 25, 6. And tell me, you know, for the listeners, tell us that verse and its significance in this context. But also, maybe you can comment on whether all of these thinkers would have relied on that for their explanation of India and Indians.
Actually, only one of the 10 thinkers, only two of the 10 thinkers that I studied relied on this particular verse to interpret the relationship between Judaism and Hinduism. Only two. So none of the medieval thinkers came up with it. Not even the 19th century travelers or the Enlightenment geographer. I'll repeat that.
Sure thing, take your time.
Not even the 19th century thinkers used that verse. So I, as I said in my chapter, I actually came across that verse when I visited Jerusalem.
For those listening, yes, you'll have to tell us what the verse says.
I will, okay. So I asked some Orthodox rabbis, what was the relationship between Judaism and Buddhism? And they referred to this verse. I will read what this verse says. But to the sons of the concubines whom Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from his son Isaac while he still lived, eastward to the land of the east. And they said that verse actually means gifts of knowledge that Abraham gave to his six sons. They went, and east here means really east, all the way to India. And he sent his sons. So he sent his sons with gifts of Jewish knowledge to India. And this Jewish knowledge became the basis of Hinduism and Buddhism. And the followers of Abraham were the Brahmins, because in Hebrew or Latin, so Avraham and Brahman sound very similar. So that proves the Brahmins are descended from Abraham intellectually.
And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that there is a flip side of that, that we might be able to find Orthodox Brahmins who would say that, you know, because each side from a theological perspective might be inclined to obviously subsume the entire world through a particular worldview. So what would they say? You know, Abraham was a Brahmanical. He left the Brahmanical tradition and he was Abraham.
Yes. I found some internet pages that said that.
Oh, I was half joking, but I'm glad that such things exist in the world. That's so interesting. Okay, what would you? So 30,000 foot view, big picture. What do you hope folks would take away from this book overarchingly? What's the general thrust or message of this book, or fruit of it? What would you like them to learn reading this book?
I looked at my conclusion because I thought that would be the answer to your question. And the conclusion is almost incomprehensible if you haven't read the book already, because it summarizes a lot of what these thinkers said. Let me give a somewhat different answer. First of all, as I said before, one takeaway is that there really is a history of Jewish thinking and interest in Hinduism. But that's, you could know this already from a few things that other scholars have written. Second, that history is very complex. Each of these chapters has a lot of information. Each of these chapters is based on a complex argument. There really was no simple thing that any one of these authors thought about Hinduism. And what they did think about Hinduism was shaped. What they did think about Hinduism was shaped often by random causes. Whatever information happened to be available to them really influenced their conclusions. So another takeaway is that Jewish views of Hinduism are really embedded, rooted in a particular historical period and way of thinking, a philosophical language, a view of Judaism, and just information, all sorts of information, unpredictable information about Hinduism. The other thing that I was interested in the book, and really every chapter was moving towards this question, was how did Jews compare religions outside the monotheisms? If a religion wasn't Islam or Christianity, how did they go about comparing? What was important to them? So at the end of it's an important part of each chapter, I try to answer that question. So another takeaway is that Jews really did have theories of comparative religion. They engaged in comparative religion. It wasn't very open-minded. did not stand up to modern expectations of how one would compare religions in a fair and open-minded way, but they did develop theories comparing.
Now, just Just to be clear, the theorization about other religions, this comparative enterprise that you describe, is it fair to say that this all occurred within the Abrahamic worldview? Or did some, or were some of them actually able to think outside of that in terms of biblical time, biblical space, being heirs of Abraham, etc.?
Sure. I think the only, so most of them could not think outside. The only one that maybe we can say did think outside of a traditional Jewish view of the world was the author influenced by the European Enlightenment movement, the Haskalah in Hebrew. And his categories were rather universal ones. God, ethics, religious institutions, transcendence. These were categories that appeared in Jewish philosophy, but otherwise were not part of the traditional rabbinic Jewish way of looking at the world. But otherwise, it was all from within traditional Judaism. And if I can say more about the way they compared, what I discovered is that, of course, I mean, it's to be expected, they all considered Judaism the superior religion and the religion of absolute truth. So when they looked at another religion, even though they might have thought they were being objective, they weren't. They were judging other religions by their own religion. It wasn't always the same thing from author to author of their own religion, because they had many different views of Judaism too. So in a way, you can't say the Jewish view of Hinduism, because there were a lot of different Jewish views, and because there were different concepts of Judaism. But anyway, they judged from their own version of Judaism in some way. What I found is a lot of them looked at other religions from what they consider the essential theology of Judaism. Some of the authors compared other religions based on, say, the morality of Judaism or what we might call sociology, that is like the institution of priesthood. But again, that comes out of Judaism. Some of them judged other religions from a concept in Hebrew called dat, which is translated today as religion, but it means a set of social and religious regulations, and implies revelation, and Jews would judge how much some other religion manifested this essence of religion, and they included so this dot, this religiosity, was manifested fully in Islam and Christianity and Judaism, of course. But the question then was, how much did other religions manifest this dot? And what else? Another way they compared implicitly was by using Jewish language or Hebrew language to translate religious phenomena. For example, Hindus would pray in a Beit Tefillah, which is the Hebrew word for house of prayer. Hindus would study laws and interpret them. And that's sounding like rabbis, what rabbis do. I can't think of other examples. Jacob Sapir, when he described certain Hindu. When Sapir described certain Hindu rituals, he used the Hebrew language of sacrifices at the temple, the ancient temple in Jerusalem. Did he intend to compare them explicitly? Probably this language just came to him automatically, because that's what it looked like. But anyway, so I'm saying that a third way that Jews compared religions was simply by using the language of their own religion to identify or depict what Hindus were doing. This is a kind of comparative religion. It wasn't, in some ways, it was a failure to imagine something different, to find a neutral category to describe what Hindus were doing. But still, it was an act of saying, yeah, they're doing the same thing as our rabbis did, or we did in the temple ourselves.
Certainly in the time and spaces of these thinkers, there was no etic paradigm. I mean, the emic paradigm was all was all that was. I mean, it was describing the world always happened from within a religious, moral, philosophical perspective. And that just pretty much was the way things were in the Jewish world and the Hindu world. And so unsurprisingly, they would rely on known structures of thought, known idioms, you know, known religious phenomena. So, you know, that sort of makes sense. One of the key things that occurs to something that stands out in my mind is the extent to which each of these case studies is different insofar as that they're sometimes reinventing the wheel. It's not that there is a tradition of interpreting Hinduism that's passed on. It's these are individuals who encountered a new somewhat and make sense of it with respect to their specific context, their specific mindset, their specific education. I find that quite interesting as well.
Yes, I think that is exactly what happened. You're right.
Right. We are at time for today. So thank you very much for appearing on the podcast.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
I'm glad you had your doubts, but I told you we'd be talking about Hinduism.
I apologize for coughing so much.
Oh, that's all right. The audience probably won't even know that you did, because we will edit that out. So
you will. Okay.
Just stay on one moment while I formally sign off. So for those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Richard Marks, Professor Emeritus at Washington and Lee University, on his brand new Routledge 2022 publication, Jewish Approaches to Hinduism. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating how religions understand other religions. Take care.